Right now on the Daily Debrief, friends describe finding the body of a murdered law professor.
His head was bloody.
The victim's last words on the phone.
There's an unfamiliar person in my driveway.
One defendant blames the other says he didn't do it. Plus,
I was scared he was going to kill me.
Former Dallas police officer Amber Geiger takes the stand on murder charges, then breaks down.
I ask God for forgiveness and I hate myself.
The judge calls a halt to the proceedings and
now let us have a little talk with Jesus. Let us tell him all about
the legacy of the man Amber Geiger shot and killed. Botham John, remembered in music. The Daily Debrief brings you The Day in Court. It's Friday, September 27th.
Welcome to The Debrief, everyone. Former Dallas police officer Amber Geiger took the stand today in her own defense, and when asked about shooting and killing a man in his own apartment, she broke down and forced a halt to the proceedings. Here is how it happened.
I want to go through a few things that happened at that door and in that room with you now, okay?
Yes, sir.
And I need you to step in.
Geiger is the Dallas police officer accused of shooting and killing Botham John. As her defense started to walk her through the shooting, the judge called a halt to the proceedings out of a likely concern that the defendant's emotions could prejudice the jury. Geiger was sexting a coworker when she went into the wrong apartment, thinking it was her own apartment. Inside, she encountered Botham John, an accountant who she shot and killed, thinking he was an intruder. At some point, she realized she was in the wrong place. The defense says the complex is confusing and that many who live there have made similar mistakes. The prosecutor says she should have noticed the clues that she was in the wrong. Four attorneys are watching with us tonight. Lakai Vinson is in Charlotte, North Carolina. Michael Troiano in Las Vegas. Brian Buckmeyer and Kirk Burkhalter are with me here in New York. Let's listen as the defendant breaks down again. At times, the court reporter couldn't understand her testimony. At times, the state objected.
And you fired? Why did you fire?
Here's how Amber Geiger says the shooting happened. She says she approached the apartment door, noticed it was cracked open, and put her key in the lock to go inside. She explains hearing someone inside and being scared.
I heard moving around inside my apartment.
What type of moving around?
Like loud shuffling, someone walking.
Okay. What happened when the key actually went into the keyhole?
It forced the door open.
What were you feeling? But that door.
Scared as crap.
Okay. As the door opened, did you see anything in your apartment?
Yes, I did. That's whenever directly in the middle towards the window is when I saw the silhouette figure standing back there. I used my left arm to fully open it, and at that time, that's whenever I'm drawing my service weapon out. And I yelled at him, it's like, let me see your hands, let me see your hands. He started coming towards me.
How fast was he coming towards you?
A fast-paced walk.
Wasn't running. When you saw him coming towards you, what was going through your mind?
I thought that he was coming at me. He said he couldn't see his hands, he was going to kill me.
Did you hear anything as he was walking towards you?
There was a loud yell. He was yelling, hey, 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 in an aggressive voice.
And that's at that point whenever I shot.
Somewhere in this area?
Yes.
When you shot, what happened?
He fell down.
On cross-examination, the prosecutor demanded to know why Geiger was sexting her partner on the police force instead of helping Botham Jean.
He must have stopped completely giving him CPR when you sent a message to Martin Rivera saying, I need to hurry, right?
I did text him that.
Okay, and so you must have at that point stopped CPR entirely.
Yes, I did.
And then not even a minute later, you must have stopped CPR entirely again to send a second message to Martin Rivera.
I was already out in the hallway.
Oh, so you had already left him?
That's whenever they told me to leave, the officers.
So that's, no, ma'am, I'm talking about at 10:03 p.m. Mr. Lee, Officer Lee, and Officer Blair didn't arrive until almost 10:05.
Yes, I do remember that, like, whenever they showed me, I sent those text messages.
You texted Mr. Rivera using your hands.
Yes, I did.
And as you were doing that, you were unable to give Mr. Jean your full attention, the attention that he deserved.
Yes, I did.
And then you made the choice to do that a second time. Isn't that true?
Yes, sir.
All right, so at both of those times, you put your needs and your wants over his.
I still cared about him.
Did you put your needs and your wants over him when you decided to do that?
No, sir.
Let's begin discussing this testimony with our guests who are watching from afar. Michael Troiano is in Las Vegas, Lakai Vincent in Charlotte, North Carolina. Let's start with you. The big question is whether or not this defendant is believable and truthful. What's your assessment?
Well, I think she certainly comes off as believable, but there is question as to her credibility because of those text messages. Even if you wanted to like her, if you do like her, then there is a slight dislike based on the fact that she is texting, sexting her partner turned lover at the time in which she should be giving CPR and rendering aid. But I think overall, she comes across credible, and you have to have some sympathy for her, even if it's impermissible and you don't want to.
Of course, Michael Troiano, there's a big question of sympathy. There's also the question of legal culpability here. The defendant sitting there saying she was sorry, there were objections in there. Was that rehearsed? What did you make of that?
Well, absolutely, it was rehearsed in some aspect. If they're going to put her on the stand, the defense team needs to explain what are the goals that they're attempting to accomplish. And a major goal is expressing to the jury that she was remorseful. They need to get into the minds of the jury and remove her from being just solely this cold, calculated RoboCop, if you will, and be somebody who's sympathetic, who was scared, alone, and they're trying to remove the badge and place her in a position that we could all relate to, coming home to our supposed place of living and finding a stranger in there that you weren't expecting.
With me here in New York are Brian Buckmeyer and Kirk Burkhalter. So, Kirk, the big legal question here is whether or not the fear that she says she felt was a reasonable fear. Is it reasonable for her to believe that the person coming at her in that apartment was going to kill her? That's what she testified to.
And I'll provide an answer that's not going to be helpful at all. It would be reasonable if it was reasonable for her to believe that was her apartment. And for me, that's the big question. It's very difficult to isolate both one from the other.
You're the law professor, and you're throwing the question back at me. Brian Buckmeyer, let's go back to the defendant's testimony. She had that line where she said that she felt she didn't deserve to spend time with her family because what she had done. You cringed when you heard it. The jury could grant her that wish.
Yeah, so there's a lot of parts of this testimony that I thought, is this her on direct to say that she's innocent, or is this during the sentencing phase? A lot of it seems to be asking for permission to have a lower sentence rather than saying, I didn't do this, or I fit into some sort of element of a defense. I think her remorse is definitely coming through here.
Professor, I'm going to go back to this reasonableness question here. Okay, you know, sure. I have to throw the question back at you here. You know, she says that she had a reasonable fear, basically. That's what it boils down to legally, because she couldn't see the victim's hands. Is that the key piece of this? I mean, she's looking at this through the lens of a police officer. Should she be judged as a police officer or as an average member of the community entering an apartment?
Well, it's very interesting. So there's an argument that she should be judged as an average member of the community, but an average member of the community doesn't enter their home wearing a uniform, having a gun on their side, and having a police radio, and having a shield, and all these other things that are indicia of law enforcement. So it's going to be difficult for her to make that argument.
This is a hard case, Brian Buckmeyer, from a legal perspective and a factual perspective.
Exactly. I think when we're talking about all these defenses, the mistake of fact, the defense of property, and the facts of how she got there, it's going to be very complicated to untangle.
Appreciate the insight from the panelists. As we heard, the text messages Geiger sent to her partner on the police force are key to understanding the chain of events. A forensic digital analyst examined those messages.
The defendant sends a Snapchat response, "Wanna touch." At 9:33, the defendant sends a text message, "Barely walking out." And these are to Martin Rivera. At 9:27 and 9:28, we see Botham Jean arriving to Southside Flats. At 9:34, we have a door event at apartment 1478, Botham Jean's apartment. At 9:38-37, the defendant receives a phone call from her partner, Martin Rivera.
And that is going to last until 9:55-21?
That's correct. At 9:59, a 911 call is placed by the defendant.
There's a 3 minute and 40 some second gap between the end of the call with Martin Rivera and the incoming call at Dallas Police Department to the 911 system.
Yes. At 10:02:06, DPD Officer Michael Lee is one of the first responding officers, and they arrive at Southside Flats. At 10:02:25, the defendant texts Martin Rivera, "I need you, hurry." This is during the 911 call. At 10:03:03, the defendant texts Martin Rivera again and says, "I f***ed up."
That's the timeline. And remember, this is a murder trial, but let's pause tonight to remember the victim of the shooting, 26-year-old Botham Jean. Videos taken by his college allow us to share his story.
Hi, I'm Botham Jean, and I am a senior accounting and management information systems major, and I am from the island of St. Lucia.
That is the voice, and this is the face of the man whose life ended with the pull of a trigger in Dallas. Chaos surrounded Botham Jean's final moments, but friends and family remember other things, a bright smile and uplifting music. At Harding University, a Christian college in Arkansas,
let's praise God this morning.
Jean was an active singer.
Bless the Lord, O my soul.
In the trial of his shooter, Botham Jean's sister described him from the witness stand as his portrait sat nearby.
When he started high school, he started a choir at the high school. He also started song leading at our church, Church of Christ, and he fell in love with music. He even wrote songs, church songs.
Mourners who attended Jean's funeral wore red, his favorite color.
He was very active in his community, in his hometown, in St. Lucia, in terms of serving the youth and in terms of just doing a lot of community service.
Attorney Sue Ann Robinson is of counsel to a law firm which represents Jean's relatives.
The family does definitely want Amber Geiger brought to justice for what she did. I think the outcome is going to be a conviction on murder. That is the outcome that they're looking for.
Yes, there is evidence Botham Jean was not perfect. He used marijuana to treat ADHD. When that became public, critics lashed out at those who thought it disparaged him. And back at Harding, Jean leaves a legacy.
Let the weak say I am strong.
The university and his family cherish the music.
We found four songs that he wrote. All about Christ and wanting to get to heaven.
It's not just notes and words. A planned $50,000 scholarship in Jean's honor swelled to more than $500,000 with support from his employer.
The family has chosen to deal with it by celebrating his life, as opposed to focusing on how his life has ended.
Botham Jean. A life ended with tragedy, a legacy of hope.
Just a little talk with Jesus makes it right.
Oh, it's all right.
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 It's all right. Just a little talk with Jesus makes it right.
That was his music. And still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, the killing of a Florida law professor. Friends describe the victim's final words as an on-again, off-again couple mount different defenses to murder charges. That case when we return. A Florida jury which found a man guilty of sexually assaulting and killing a 9-year-old girl is determining whether to put him to death as well. Felicia Williams disappeared in 2014 and her naked body later turned up on a causeway in Old Tampa Bay. Defendant Granville Ritchie now stands convicted. The penalty phase of his case is expected to stretch through the day today. Now to the trial of an on-again, off-again Florida couple accused of murdering a law professor. The victim in this case, Dan Markell, was in a nasty custody battle with his ex-wife, Wendy. Prosecutors point to this battle as a potential motive for Markell's death. Neither Wendy nor any of her family have been charged. The defendants here are Sigfredo Garcia and Catherine McBanawa. She blames him. He says he didn't do it. It was the victim's neighbor who alerted police.
We heard a loud bang and a car pulled away from next door. I came over and looked in. The garage door was up, and I thought the gentleman was backing out. And I went back to my house, but he never backed out. And I came back over, and his driver's side window is shattered, and he's battered and can't answer. He's inside. I don't know if somebody tried to shoot him or if he shot himself or what. I don't know.
Okay, what's going on with him?
I don't know. The driver's side window is all bashed in. He's inside. The car is running, and he's got blood all over his head. He's just moving his head around, but he's not responding. I've called his name, asked what's going on, and I call his name, ask him what's happening. He's not responding to that, but his head's kind of rolling around.
You said there was another vehicle that you called driving away?
Yes. We heard a noise, a loud noise, and then I looked over and a car was backing up. It looked sort of like it was light colored, white or silver. I want to say it was a Prius, but it could have been a different car, but a small car about that size.
Looks like I should have an officer coming up the roadway.
One of Dan Markell's friends was on the phone with the victim when Markell pulled into the driveway and told the friend on the phone to hold on. The fateful conversation resulted in this testimony.
He said, "Can you please hold on a second? There's an unfamiliar person in my driveway." I said, "Yeah, sure." And then I waited for him to get back to me. He never did. I heard a loud sound. And then I heard him breathing like this. He never spoke another word to me. I asked him, "Are you okay?" I screamed into the phone, "Are you okay?" And then I hung up and texted him, "Are you okay? Is everything okay?" And then I called 911.
The first responding officer testified he found the victim in his car, which was parked in the garage.
I was sitting in the front seat of the car. I called out his name and I got no response. And I got a little closer, called again, no response. And he was sitting in the front seat, kind of slumped forward, and there was a gasping to his breath. But he was not responding to me, and his arms were down in front of him. I saw blood on his shirt, around his face, and then also down onto the seat.
And you said that the cell phone was in his left hand?
Yeah, and I believe in his right hand was a business card of some kind. Vehicle was locked. The window that was broken out on the driver's side, I reached in when I used the pen, hit the unlock, opened the door with the pen, and reached in, turned the car off.
And did the EMTs provide medical assistance that you observed?
Yes. Myself and Officer Bradshaw and Officer Brandon, we had to use the keys that were taken out of the ignition to unlock the door in the garage into the house to search the house. That door was locked.
Was there anything indicating a sign of a struggle or a robbery inside the residence?
No.
Or outside, for that matter?
No.
Now to our guests to discuss this case, Lakai Vincent and Michael Troiano. Michael, the motive here is really complex, and I thought that during the opening statements, the prosecutor should have made some kind of a chart or a map or something like that to really solidify it, because you've got the victim, you've got the ex-wife, you've got these two defendants that have some tenuous connections to other family members. It's a lot here for this jury to unravel.
Absolutely, but when you put yourself in the position of the prosecution, I think it's beneficial to kind of get that all out early and explain, hey, there's going to be a lot of details in this case. It's going to go in several different directions. There's going to be a lot of finger pointing, and kind of lay out the basis of the plot or the prologue, if you will, to make sure that once they get the evidence and the specific witnesses that they feel are important in front of them, that at that point they'll be ready to take some notes and pay close attention.
Certainly. Lakai Vinson, this is an interesting trial because you have one defendant blaming the other saying that he didn't do it at all, and they're both being tried together. Do you see an issue here? Because I sort of do.
Well, certainly. Whenever you have two defendants coming together before the jury, it makes it that much more complicated because now they have to decide which are, if both defendants are guilty or innocent. And then on top of it, when you have one defendant saying, hey, I'm not involved, but this defendant did it, and this defendant is saying, I'm not in fact guilty, it complicates things even further. So it is really going to be a tough job for the prosecution to parse out all those details and make it clear for the jury.
I agree with that as well. Let's turn to our panel here in New York, Kirk Burkhalter, Brian Buckmeyer. So Brian, Sigfredo Garcia was caught on some wiretaps. Looks like that's going to be the key evidence here against him. And that's why Catherine McBonawa says that she's exonerated because they don't directly name her.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. It's a web when you think of all the people and how they're connected. And this web is only going to be as strong as the silk that it's constructed from. And these wiretaps are going to be the ones that connect him to the decedents. And if they're strong enough, that could be guilty.
Kirk Burkhalter, give us the professor's explanation of this case. Complicated, convoluted. Some people have said it's soap opera-like. How are you reading it?
It's very complicated. Now, first of all, I'm a law professor and I drive a dark Honda Accord, so that's a little disturbing. But it's also an extremely convoluted case. And I agree, it's like asking a compound question. How is your day today? Are you hungry? What are you doing tomorrow? What's the jury gonna focus on?
I'll just say yes.
Exactly, exactly. So will they say yes to everything? Will they say no to everything? Will they have the sophistication to really parcel through all this? And that's the job.
And Brian, you're the defense attorney here. If I'm the defense attorney, I need to make it really clear to the jury. You need to look at my client in isolation from the other client.
Absolutely. You want to say, this is all white noise. Let me push this back, push this away, and let's focus on one, this thing only. And if you focus on it, my guy's not guilty.
Appreciate the insight from the panel. And thank you for joining us on The Debrief, live trial coverage. If you're watching here on the Law and Crime Network, we'll resume in just a moment. For The Debrief, we'll see you tomorrow.